Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. It is Wednesday, January the 23rd, 2019. And as you just heard in the headline news there at the opening of the hour, an Iowa judge has struck down the Iowa law protecting the life of the unborn once there is what is called a fetal heartbeat. Once a heartbeat is discernible, the law in Iowa said it was a human life. And so that would be the standard that would be the standard against which the question of may this person now be aborted, that would be the test. And the judge has said that the woman's right usurps the right to life of the unborn. And so I think that when we talk about this conversation about when life begins, you know that I have described my own pro-life position as from conception to natural death. So obviously I concur with the governor of the state of Iowa when she says, look, if the cessation of a heartbeat is the end of a life, if we judge that to be the end of life, then how is it that a heartbeat does not suggest to us that life has begun? Like, it seems perfectly reasonable, right? So when we think about the constitutionality of rights and whose rights prevail over other people's rights, this is actually going to, I think, in large measure be the theme of much of today's program. Now, in the middle of the program, I'm going to have a delightful conversation with Kara K. James about a really wonderful book called Mom Up. And so if you tuned in today to hear my conversation with Kara K. James about Mom Up, Thriving with Grace in the Chaos of Motherhood, we are going to get to that in the third segment of today's show. But let me lead off with some anguish that I am feeling out of what's going on in New York. And then I would say this ruling in Iowa deepens my grief, if that be possible. I got up this morning thinking to myself, I think I understand the anguish that's expressed in the scriptures when it describes people as rending their robes or donning sackcloth and ashes. And they're doing that because that which is happening around them is so grievous, and they know that it so deeply grieves the heart of God that they have no other way to express that they're with God in his grief at what is happening upon the earth, that they're trying to express in some kind of tangible way that they understand how grieved God is at the state of things. And so yesterday, the law of the state of New York was amended to allow a woman to abort her child up to the very point of birth for any reason. And if that child be born alive after a botched abortion, it is no longer protected under New York state law. So my way of describing this is Moloch has his worshipers yet today. This false god is now receiving as a sacrifice the children of America. And they're being sacrificed on what I will describe as the altar of autonomy or choice. So this law signed yesterday in celebration of the anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision, by the way. Like, they chose yesterday intentionally to do this. Governor Cuomo signed this law into effect, obliterating what was New York's already very permissive barrier to abortion at 24 weeks. So this so-called Reproductive Health Act now allows people who are not medical doctors to perform abortions. And following the governor's, placing his signature, during which, I mean, if you're to watch the videos of this as it unfolded, it's sickening. They're joking around, they're smiling, they're laughing, and there is uproarious applause and and cheering when this is signed into law. The entire State House of New York, and including a lot of people in the gallery. I mean, if you watch the videos, it's so disturbing. What they are celebrating is the murder of children. That's what they're celebrating. And it's, I don't have another word for it other than disturbing. I know we're not angry at anybody here on Faith Radio, but I feel righteous anger about this. So I'm gonna address it that way because I don't know any other affect to have that would be appropriate. If I had robes to rend and if I had sackcloth and ashes to put on, I would be. This is grievous. The governor of New York went on to say that he plans to seek the amendment, that the Constitution of the state of New York be amended so that no future administration might be able to change what this current group of elected politicians deems as right and righteous, which is this unlimited, unfettered, taxpayer-funded abortion up to the very point of birth of any child for any reason. And not only that, they intend to lead the country in this. Let me read what the governor, part of what the governor said. The Reproductive Health Act is a historic victory for New Yorkers and for our progressive values. In the face of a federal government intent on rolling back Roe v. Wade and women's reproductive rights, I promised that we would enact this critical legislation within the first 30 days of the new session, and we got it done. I am directing, listen to this, that New York's landmarks be lit up in pink, which, you know, used to be, you know, the signal of the birth of a baby girl. Today, it is the celebration of the slaughter of the innocents. I mean, that's me amending his comments, obviously. The governor said, I am directing that New York's landmarks be lit in pink to celebrate this achievement and shine a bright light forward for the rest of the nation to follow. Okay, did you hear that? He ordered that New York's landmarks be lit in pink to celebrate this quote-unquote achievement. So they are celebrating it, first of all. They consider it achievement, second of all. And then he characterized it as shining a bright light forward for the rest of the nation to follow. Let us be clear what is happening here. So what does the law actually say? Section 2 of the bill creates a new Article 25A in what is called the Public Health Law of the State of New York. It now states, an abortion may be performed. This used to say by a medical doctor. This now says performed by a licensed, certified, or authorized practitioner within 24 weeks from the commencement of pregnancy. That's the old standard, by the way. That's the old hurdle of 24 weeks or the old barrier, which is going to be obliterated by the next phrase. Or there's an absence of fetal viability or at any time when necessary to protect a patient's life or health. Now, what are we talking about here? Clearly, they're not trying to protect the patient who is the baby. Clearly, the only patient in view here is the woman. But let's be clear: abortions in New York no longer have to be performed by doctors, which also means they no longer have to be authorized by doctors. So, the prior restriction of an abortion beyond 24 weeks is obliterated by this new law. Here's the phrase. Or at any time, which leads us to a criteria for late term abortion. Here's the criteria: when necessary to protect a patient's life or health. Now, if we were just to say when necessary to preserve the life of the mother, then we would be talking here about at least something that is within the realm of the rational. But when necessary to, what's the word protect mean here? One really does not know. A patient's life, and then it's amended with the words or health. Well, health is a term that is as expansive as an abortion provider's willingness to define it. A woman may, under this new law, decide at any time prior to the live birth of her child to have that child's life terminated if she determines that it's in her best interest to do so, if it's necessary for her health. If she comes to view the child as a threat to her health, physical, mental, emotional, or otherwise, then she can request and receive a taxpayer-funded abortion in the state of New York today by a non-doctor. Which leads me to ask the question, do you remember Moloch or Molech? Molech is the Canaanite god who required child sacrifice in order to be appeased. Do you also remember God's commands related to this practice? Leviticus 18, Leviticus 20, four times in Leviticus 20, excuse me. Also again in 2 Kings 23 and in Jeremiah 32. God says things like this: thou shalt not let any of thy seed pass through the fire to Molech. That means nobody is supposed to render their children unto this false god who requires child sacrifice. In Leviticus 20, this appears in four successive verses. Leviticus 20, verse 2, 3, 4, and 5. Again, thou shalt say to the children of Israel, whosoever be of the children of Israel, or of the strangers that sojourn in Israel, that giveth any of his seed to Molech, he shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. I will set my face against that man. I will cut him off from among his people, because he hath given his seed unto Molech to defile my sanctuary, to profane my holy name. This is God talking here. If the people of the land do in any way hide their eyes from the man, then he giveth his seed to Molech and kill him not. Then I will set my face against that man and against his family, and I will cut him off and all that go whoring after him to commit whoredom with Molech from among their people. God does not like the practice of child sacrifice. God sets his face against it like flint. God's heart is grieved that we would take the good and precious gift of the next generation and sacrifice it on the altar of autonomy or choice. Now, I want you to hear what I'm saying, and I want to be certain that you hear what I'm not saying. I am not saying that abortion is an unforgivable sin. I am saying it is sin. Not by my definition, but by the very word of God. We do not sacrifice the seed of a human life on the altar of any false god, be it Molech, be it autonomy, be it choice, be it the preservation of some expansive definition of health in the moment. I recall John Stone Street saying last year in reaction to what was going on, actually, I think it was in Belgium, you know, they started euthanizing kids over there. He said something like this: everything has to be sacrificed for the demon gods of autonomy and choice. Well, friends, the state of New York has now become likened unto the Valley of Hinnom, or Gehenna, in the scriptures, a place where some of the kings of Judah sacrificed their own children, and God said through the prophet of Jeremiah, it would therefore be cursed. If we take seriously what God says about human life, and if we take seriously what God has said in his word about the gift of children and the responsibility that we bear as stewards of their little lives, then today is a day for the rending of robes and the putting on of sackcloth and ashes and crying out to the Lord our God for this disgrace in our land. Friends, I got to take a quick break. When I come back, we are going to move on to other subject matter. This is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I am your host, Carmen LaBurge, and thank you for bearing with me through the opening segment. It's difficult material that we're covering today. I want to turn now to other headlines. So I really do attempt to take a pretty wide survey of what's happening locally, nationally, internationally, in the news, and really seek to bring us talking points and conversations here on Connecting Faith that will equip us to enter the conversations of the day, bearing out the very mind of Christ. Periodically, I lift up international headlines that may seem to you like genuinely far removed from our situation. But sometimes I'm lifting them up because these are our brothers and sisters in Christ. And these are the people with whom we're going to spend all of eternity in the kingdom of heaven. And so it's imperative that we not only know what they're suffering now, but what we might do in response to their suffering to alleviate it, to relieve it, to intervene, not only before the throne of God, although absolutely there first, that we need to pray the news in these circumstances, but that we might also be mobilized as brothers and sisters in Christ around the globe to bring, you know, whatever our collective witness is to bear on these situations. So let me lift up again today what's happening with the Christians in what has historically been Iraq. And so we would call these the Iraqi Christians. We would call this a portion of the world the Nineveh Plain. We have talked about the Nineveh Plain on many occasions. We have talked about the fact that ISIS drove most every person out of northern Iraq. And we have talked about the efforts to help those Christians who want to move back into the Nineveh Plain, the cradle of Christianity. We've talked about efforts to come alongside them and rebuild their communities. And so this came as particularly disturbing news to me, and I found it at the National Catholic Register, which is an international news reporting effort by the Roman Catholic Church, and they have great relationships with Orthodox communities around the globe as well. And so this is posted there by Edward Penton. He is the reporter based in Europe. So he has a little closer access maybe than we do. So he is describing here the plight of Iraqi Christians as a new threat emerges. So here's the lead. ISIS may be practically gone in northern Iraq, but Christians now face another challenge. The Shabak, a Shia group that is more subtly pushing Christians out of the towns in the Nineveh Plain. So he visits here with folks who are on the ground to get a genuinely on the ground look at what's happening at these once Christian towns on the Nineveh Plain. And it focuses on three towns in particular. One is Bartella, which you may remember because it was featured in a photograph where there were at the liberation of Bartella, there were people who were not Christians. I mean, they are Muslims who were actually replacing the cross on the dome of the church in Bartella for the Christians who might then be willing to return. So it was Bartella is one of the towns that we are actually familiar with. Karakush is another one, the name of which you might have heard. And Karam Lesh is a third. So they are struggling to rebuild after the invasion of ISIS in 2014. These towns have been liberated. They were liberated in 2017. And so we're 2 years on now, or a year and a half on. And so what's happening now, and how might we play a role in helping them return and actually rebuild their lives and thrive? So this is now, these three towns are now in what is called the disputed territory. And that means that they are like on the edge. And if you're in the disputed territory, you're not really under anybody's sort of hedge of protection. You're not within the bounds that anybody is really taking care of. So there's all these political differences in the Nineveh Plain between the Kurds and the Iraqis. And so right now, this area is really under the control of a Shia militia. It's called the PMF, the Popular Mobilization Force. And there is a separation between what's going on in Erbil, which is the capital of Kurdistan, and what's going on in the Nineveh Plain. And so you really almost have to think of this as, you know, two different countries. The Kurds don't like the Shabak, and that's a precarious situation for Christians in the region because the Christians do not have any arms with which to defend themselves. And so they have to really be helped by somebody. So we're talking here not only about political control, we're also talking here about simply the ability to move back into the community where you once lived and rebuild your life. And so unless the Iraqi government were actually to order these Shia militias to leave the area and restore these homes and other facilities to the Christians who once lived there, nothing's really going to change because the Christians are going to be able to force these people out. And so imagine that you went through the whole process of returning only to find that your house was now inhabited by one of these Shia militia members and having no ability to have them leave so that you can move back in, so that you can begin rebuilding your life and your community. So that's what's going on. And we want to certainly be lifting this situation up in prayer. I want to share with you some of the content of this article where it talks about how the situation has actually gotten worse instead of gotten better. And so Here are the answers to the question. Well, there are some good things. For example, in Karakush, they've done some rebuilding. It's very impressive. They built a kind of Christian cultural center there. It has a nice library. There's actually an orchestra and music project that's going on. And then he says, but the roads have deteriorated much worse than they were, especially because it's been raining. USAID, which is the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID is not helping with the roads. And so some of the things that people are asking for are simply not getting done because there's no way to transport anything. So another problem is the Christians are saying the Shabak are being helped more than the Christians because assistance is for religious minorities. And these Shia are religious minorities in this part of the country. And so that's a challenge as well, right? You and I like to use religious minority language because in these places, obviously Christians are religious minorities, and it makes it sound as if we are interested in, and I think we are, everybody who finds themselves in a minority status as a religion in a majority religious community. But in this particular case, the Shia are capitalizing on the fact that the funds from USAID are supposed to be distributed to religious minorities. And while we might mean Christian, they're interpreting that to mean Shia Muslims in this dominant Kurdish and Sunni part of the country. So I just thought that I would lift this up today as a point of concern, as a point of prayer, and as a point of political persuasion. Maybe that's the other way to say it. According to this National Catholic Register article, there are there's positive signs, but there's also what is described here as a focus on basic survival. There's real anxiety here. Father Benham Benoka, who's the parish priest in Bartella, said it's almost as if within the next year their future will be decided. Will they survive or will they die? And so I think that, you know, we imagine that once ISIS has been driven out of a region, everything can return to normal. The problem is that what happens in that vacuum in between, what happens in the time between when ISIS is driven out and when, in this case, Christians are able to return to their communities and begin rebuilding their lives, other people move in. And I want you to just imagine for a moment what that must be like. And then remember that this is happening to our Christian brothers and sisters. And so I want us to pray for them as siblings. I want us to acknowledge that, you know, we're going to spend all of eternity with these brothers and sisters in Christ. And they're going to know that we knew, and they're going to know whether or not we did anything with the knowledge that we possessed in this time, in this day and age, where we can, well, frankly, know just about anything going on anywhere. All right, friends, next up, I am going to be talking with Kara K. James about her book, Mom Up, Thriving with Grace in the Chaos of Motherhood. If you've got a pile of clothes, there are toys strewn everywhere, the dishes are piling up. We want to equip you to live a full, abundant life of parenting the little people God has entrusted to your care in this season. And to help us do that, we're going to talk with Kara K. James of Thriving Moms. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Thrilled to be joined in conversation today by Kara K. James. She is the founder and executive director of Thrive Moms. It's a ministry dedicated to empowering moms. You can find them everywhere, thrivemoms.com, Thrive Moms on Facebook and Instagram. You can find Kara K. on Twitter at Kara K. James. Kara K., welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this is a fun book, and it's a fun vision. So let's just start with the title, Mom Up. What's Mom Up? Where did that phrase come from?
Well, it kind of came off of a playoff of Man Up. And so as I was kind of writing this book and thinking through, I thought, you know, I really want to call moms, not call them out in a bad way, but I want to call moms to a higher calling, because I feel like moms are getting a bad rap, that so many moms were feeling like, well, it's okay. I'm just a mom, so I don't, you know, I'm not expected to do anything more. And I said, you know what? I think that moms we're expected to do a lot more. I think that God expects us to, you know, he's given us this role of raising these children to be followers of him. And so we have this huge responsibility. And so I wanted to call moms out into that and say, it's time to mom up. It's time to step into this calling that we have and realize the importance of the job we have, that the job we have is not just, you know, wiping faces or making lunches or taking our kids to soccer practice, that the job we have has eternal impact, and it's so, so important. And so while it kind of started as a joke of, you know, man up, we can mom up, it really has this higher calling of that we have this huge eternal impact of raising these children.
So I'm trying to imagine some of my mom friends when they might be wallowing in some sort of mom self-pity, and I'm responding to them with, you know, hey, mom up, like, you know, we got this. Like, God would not have entrusted the sacred life of this other person to your stewardship if he didn't trust you. And so he's entrusted you with the shepherding of this other life. So, you know, mom up. Like, that's my sense of what you're trying to say.
Yeah. And so exactly that God didn't make you your kid's mom by accident. You know, I think a lot of us feel like, oh man, I am not cut out for this job. I cannot do this. And I have been there. I have so many times I felt like I am not cut out for this. I have four kids. And they are overwhelming, and they are loud and noisy and chaotic. And a lot of times people think, well, you do all of this, so you must have the perfect kids, the perfect life. It must be really easy. And that is not the case at all. I'm not even naturally a great mom. I'm not a good cook. I'm not good at doing the Pinteresty things. I don't necessarily like being around my kids all the time. And I think a lot of moms don't even want to admit that. I think that we feel like we have to have it all together and we have to do all the things right all the time, but we have to realize that the most important thing we can do is just to be a really good mom for our kids in the way that God made us. And that's by, you know, focusing on who he is and who he made us to be for them, and that we can lead our kids to him. And it really doesn't have to go too crazy. Like, we don't have to be the perfect Pinterest mom and all those things to be a great mom.
Friends, my conversation partner today is Kara K. James. We're talking about her book, Mom Up, Thriving with Grace in the Chaos of Motherhood. So I think that we can do something to change the perception of motherhood in the culture today, and maybe even how moms feel. I think you've described two ends of a great spectrum, like people who feel like, oh, I'm only just a mom. And whatever it is that we have done to make women feel as if being a mom is not the greatest and most significant calling ever, we've done that wrong. So we need to change that. But then there's this other extreme where you describe, like, I have to be the perfect Pinterest mom. Like, I have to keep my Facebook posts have to be as good as everybody else, or my Christmas card or whatever. Yeah. And so both of those are wrong. So help us change. Yeah. Help us change that.
Okay, so in the book, I talk about in one aspect of being like finding your sweet spot as being a mom and finding your sweet spot with your kids. And so for
mine would be nap time. Everybody's nap time is my sweet spot.
Absolutely, absolutely, for all of us. And my nap time as well.
That's fine. That's what I mean.
I have four kids that are so crazy, wildly different. And I never thought it would be that way. And so I realized, you know, I was trying to be this like cookie cutter mom of, okay, I'm supposed to do this thing and this is how I can be a good mom. But I realized I have to be a different person for each one of my kids. And in order to connect with them in the best ways, in order to lead them in the best ways, because they're just tiny human beings and they have different personalities, just like all of us do. And I love that, you know, how we're all learning, you know, everybody's all into the Enneagram and all these different things, of we're all learning about ourselves as adults, but it's so interesting to, as we watch kids grow into who they are too, because they're all so different. And so if we can look at our kids and realize, okay, this is a little person that has their own personality, they function in their own way, and how can I best come alongside them and be the best mom I can be for them specifically, it really can help us to not try to fit into that mold of being the mom like the woman we see on Facebook who seems to have it all together, which typically she doesn't, you know. It just appears that way on the internet.
That's exactly
and,
right.
And so we just have to find that sweet spot, the ways that work for us individually with our kids individually. Maybe you have one kid, maybe you have four or five, you know, just to figure out what works for you in that really sweet spot that can make you, you know, find you those avenues that you can thrive in and you can connect with your kids on deeper levels, as opposed to just, you kind of, we all get into that survival mode of, okay, we got to do this. We got to do this. We're on this routine of come home, put your backpack down, get your homework done, you know, go to practice, go to dinner, you know, and we get into that and we totally forget about the heart aspect behind this really important job. And we have to focus on that, even if it's just in those tiny little moments, you know, in the car between this thing and that, just finding those moments to focus on them, see who they are, learn about them, and begin to grow with them. Because we grow up with our kids too, and we learn a lot about ourselves as we learn about them.
So, friends, we're talking with Kara K. James today about her book, Mom Up. The book is actually broken up into five sections where readers get to explore how to transform from living in what's described as constant survival mode to actually thriving in abundance. So those five sections all start with the declaration, a thriving mom. And so a thriving mom is made for more. A thriving mom is an intentional mom. A thriving mom lives in a genuine community. A thriving mom rests in the Lord. And a thriving mom embraces chaos. Let's talk about that last one. A thriving mom embraces chaos. Because that one's kind of fun.
It is fun. Like I said, I have four kids. And so chaos is overwhelming around me. And I'm a very type A person. And so as we had kid after kid after kid, I realized, ooh, chaos is not really that easy for me. And it overwhelmed me and it stressed me. And I found that I wasn't enjoying motherhood because the chaos was just a little too much sometimes. And I know a lot of moms feel that way, because whether you're a type A person or you're a super fun mom, which I struggle with, and I have to make myself be a fun mom sometimes, but you know, we have to find ways to really find joy in the moments. And sometimes that's by us realizing that we're the adult in the room and our kids are kids. And a lot of times they don't even realize they're doing anything wrong. They're just being kids. I'll find myself in the car screaming at the kids to calm down and be quiet when they're just laughing and playing and being kids. And they look at me like, what's the matter with you, mom? Have you completely lost it? You know? And I'm like, I just want some peace and quiet. And they're like, why? That's boring. You know, they're kids and they just want to enjoy life and be kids. And sometimes I think we just have to get a little bit of perspective in our situations and realize that kids are going to be kids, and we can either live in just frustration and get into this cycle of anger and always being overwhelmed, or we can look for moments of joy and live in that. And we have so much more fun when we do that, when we can find joy in the crazy things our kids say and do, and the, you know, the silly things that happen. And that's just way more fun. And I talk in the book about how sometimes embracing chaos isn't necessarily just the everyday chaotic moments that happen, that sometimes the chaos in our lives look a little more real. And maybe that's, you know, your husband's lost his job and you're struggling to make ends meet, or your child is facing some illness and you don't know what's going on. And how can you thrive when you have real chaos, and what does that look like? It was interesting because as I was writing the book, my son, I have three girls and then a little boy. And as I was writing the book, my son was diagnosed with something called craniosynostosis, which is where the bones of his skull were not forming correctly. And he was going to have this really invasive surgery. And I mean, it's scary, you know, and he had just turned two at the time. And so it's scary to know that your baby's going to have to go through something so scary and unknown, and you don't really know what's going on. And we didn't know if there was any brain damage type of things, and so many unknown things. And because he was having, which we didn't know because he couldn't tell us, but he was having a lot of headaches because he was banging his head on things all the time. He was crying all the time. And it turns out he had so much pressure on his brain because his skull was not growing correctly. And so I had walked through this, you know, 6 to 8 months of writing this book about what it looks like to walk in abundance as a mom. And as we started going through that season, I just felt joy and I felt peace. And it seemed crazy to me. How could I feel this as I'm walking through something so terrifying? And God really showed me, this is what it means to live in abundance with me. You can be, yes, you can be afraid. You can pray and beg that I take this away from your son, but I can also give you joy in the midst of something really, really scary and, you know, very real and chaotic in your life. And so it's just learning to walk in abundance with God in the midst of whatever our chaos looks like, whether it's just that the kids are driving us crazy, or if it's that we're facing something really, really challenging. And so there's so much chaos that's going on in our world and in everyone's homes. And so that we can find joy in the midst of it, no matter what we're facing.
Well, and Kara Kay, I think that finding genuine community with other believers who mm-hmm. share some portion of our experience of chaos. So I'm going to assume that your child's craniosynostosis is of different cause than mine, but I am the parent of a now 13-year-old who has craniosynostosis as a symptom of Apert's syndrome. And so, we have walked that road for a long time.
Yeah.
And so I would love to just follow up with you personally about, you know, what might be ahead, and all of the hope related to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Friends, Kara Kay James is the author. Mom Up is the book. I actually didn't realize that I have copies. So now we're going to have a flurry of activity of our listeners who are going to be texting 877-933-2484 or emailing me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com, to enter a drawing for the copies of Mom Up, Thriving with Grace in the Chaos of Motherhood, that we have available here in the studio. So again, friends, if you want a copy, text 877-933-2484 or email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. Kara Kay, what a joy to be with you today. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Hey, friends, you can find Kara Kay online at Thrive Moms. I'm Carmen LaBurge. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we'll be right back.
You're a good, good father. It's who you are. It's who you are. It's who you are. And I'm loved by you.
It's hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Keep those texts and emails coming if you are interested in a copy of Mom Up, Thriving with Grace in the Chaos of Motherhood. Let me tell you, if you feel like you're in survival mode as a mom, this book is for you. Kara Kay really does invite us to follow Jesus more intimately ourselves in order that we might be more fully equipped to lead our children in following him. And that's really the centerpiece of what she's writing about, experiencing the true humanity and the real person in each one of our kids, and then parenting them, you know, as they require, not as we might want, but as they require. So again, you can text me 877-933-2484. You can always email me Carmen@myfaithradio.com. So this is the portion of the show where we like to do something called making the connecting point. And so my connecting point today is a bit of a response to a cultural conversation that's going on. And so if I just put these two names out there, if I put Lady Gaga out there and I put Karen Pence or Mike Pence out there, and I say we have a contest going on in terms of who is actually representing the real Jesus, the Christian faith, and who is misrepresenting Jesus and the Christian faith, because that's ultimately what this conversation comes down to. And so let me lift it up this way. We talked last week about this, what I would judge to be a totally contrived controversy that Karen Pence, the wife of the Vice President of the United States, has returned to teach art part-time at the same Christian school in suburban D.C. where she taught for nearly a decade when her husband was a member of the U.S. Congress. So where is the story? I mean, that was what I asked last week. Where's the story in this, that, you know, a professing Christian who likes art is going to return to teaching part-time at a expressly Christian school that has Christian standards for moral behavior? And where's the controversy in this? Well, yesterday, the story actually reappeared when Lady Gaga, in her show in Vegas, made this open statement to the vice president, sort of like, yo, Mike Pence, who thinks that it's acceptable that his wife works at a school that bans LGBTQ, you're wrong. You're the worst representation of what it means to be a Christian. Now, let's just pause right there. Who gets to judge who is and isn't a good or bad representative of what it means to be a Christian? And how do you ever decide who's the worst? Like, on the spectrum of good, bad, and really bad, all the way down to like totally depraved evil, are the people in the Congress of the state of New York and its governor, who some of whom profess to be Christians, who are now sacrificing children on the altar of Moloch, are they not worse representatives of what it means to be a Christian than Mike and Karen Pence, who profess to be born-again Christians? And Karen Pence is now part-time teaching at a school that operates under those same Christian principles? Like, what is going on here? This would be my question. What is going on here? You say to yourself, well, Carmen, don't make a story out of a non-story. I'm not the one making a story out of a non-story. The Guardian, which is a major newspaper in London, decided that the statement by Lady Gaga was actually worthy of an entire news story. Quote, Lady Gaga has criticized the U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and his wife Karen over her role teaching art at a school that excludes LGBTQ students and parents. On stage at her Las Vegas concert, Gaga said, and again, then here's the quote, which I've already read, you say we should not discriminate against Christianity, which she's talking there about his religious liberty positions. You are the worst representation of what it means to be a Christian. She continued, I am a Christian woman. What I know about Christianity is that we bear no prejudice and everyone is welcome. Well, if that's all she knows about Christianity, then it's paltry. Paltry. You can take all that disgrace, Mr. Pence, and you can look yourself in the mirror and you'll find it right there. That is what Lady Gaga on stage in Vegas, which, you know, people paid to go see, said to the vice president of the United States about, quote unquote, allowing his wife to take a part-time job. So let's just pause right there for just a second, because that doesn't really sound like the cultural feminist agenda. I mean, I don't know about you, but who's quote unquote letting their wife take a part-time job as an art teacher? Like, what kind of language is that? That doesn't seem to be the cutting edge language of cultural feminism. So The Guardian went on to note, Gaga defines as bisexual and has long been a champion of gay rights. So we are now a culture in which not only do we have the existence and celebrity of an entertainer named Lady Gaga, who, by the way, defines herself bisexual and presents herself as a Christian, who is making arguments about the essence of human nature, human identity, sexual identity, and sexual morality in a song called Born This Way, and is here judging the Vice President of the United States because he did not forbid his wife from taking a job as a part-time art teacher in a school that aligns with their preferred religious expression. So I'm just pausing with curiosity here to ask the question, where exactly is the free from all prejudice that Lady Gaga is calling for in her own statement? How does she get to determine that she is the righteous representation of what it means to be a Christian today, the representation of Christianity? And Mike Pence is, in her words, the worst representation of what it means to be a Christian. Well, remember, the Christian school where Karen Pence is now teaching part-time in the art department is K-8. It holds the historic it holds to historic Christian teachings, not only on the matter of biblical doctrines, you know, like who God is and who Jesus is and what the gospel is, but also when it comes to how all of that is supposed to be lived out or what the Bible says about moral purity, moral living. So how dare a woman who is a Christian teach at a school that teaches Christian values? That's sort of what the media is outraged about, what Lady Gaga is outraged about. So it hasn't ended there because, again, you're thinking that I'm making much ado about nothing, and I'm not. I'm actually reporting to you what's in the headlines of the day. Yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, the headline was The Shaming of Karen Pence. If you're going to read one article about this, read this one. It's by William McGurn, and he pointed to the cultural reaction. I mean, including John King on CNN suggesting that Mrs. Pence has done something so grievous that maybe taxpayers should not fund her secret service security protection, which basically says, hey, we shouldn't protect that woman. She should be, you know, she should be open for I don't know what. What does. OK. Let me pause. McGurn wonders what kind of message it is that the media is so concerned about. What is so terrible that Mrs. Pence has done to receive all of this public shaming across the board? As he describes it, a mob of secular Puritans has targeted Mrs. Pence for doing what? Teaching at a Christian school. So he went on to say, in a narrow sense, the vilification of Mrs. Pence makes prophetic Justice Alito's prediction in his dissent in the Obergefell case. So what we're talking here is the legalization of same-sex marriage across the country. He said it would be perilous for those who ever oppose same-sex marriage. He wrote, I assume that those who cling to old beliefs, and he's talking here to us, Christians, we will be able to whisper our thoughts in the recesses of our own homes, but we will not be able to repeat those views in public or risk being labeled as bigots and treated as such by the government, employers, schools, and the media. So I think that's where I will leave this. I am an advocate of speaking the truth on the matters of the day. I am an advocate of bringing the mind of Christ to bear on the matters of the day. This is a matter of the day that matters. And if you and I as Christians do not stand up and continue to stand for the word of God and the righteousness of moral living in this day, let me tell you, friends, if we don't stand up for Karen Pence, there's not going to be anybody to stand with. All right, that's all I got time for today on Connecting Faith. Join me right back here tomorrow or online at myfaithradio.com. Have a great night. God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.